Blog Talk Radio.
To those of you new, a few just technical issues. Broadband speed dropped this evening here in my office. I have no idea why. Other places in the house, it's fine. So hopefully the video quality will be tolerable, and hopefully sound is decent. You'll have to let me know. So I apologize for that. I apologize for what will probably be on Facebook, at least a quirky video with a lot of jumps and starts. Welcome again from very, very warm Puerto Rico. It was 87 degrees today. Not as humid as I would have expected. So kind of reminded me of California weather. It was gorgeous. It was just perfect. Could have gone to the beach. Instead, went shopping. Horrible. Hate it. Hate going shopping. Can't think of anything that disturbs me more and gets me more nervous than shopping. But anyway, a good day. The mall, I mean, one of the phenomena, and my wife was saying, was there really a hurricane here? I mean, and there is. I mean, parts of the city are still with no electricity. Half of the island is with no electricity. But the mall, there's a luxury mall here. It was packed. Packed. It's holiday season here in Latin countries, in Latin America countries, and in Catholic countries generally, they celebrate between New Year's and the 6th of December is holidays. Everybody's away and everybody's out at the mall, it turns out, because it was packed. Unbelievable. So I guess I feel a little sorry, not really, but you choose to live there. For those of you who are in Minnesota where it's 4 degrees, I'm surprised it's 4 degrees. Well, I guess tonight it'll be minus 10. Or New York, where here it's getting close to 4 degrees, and generally on the East Coast where the weather is very, very ugly. So, it's beautiful here. It's beautiful here. Good. The sound I think the sound is pretty good yesterday, but there is a bit of an echo. I can hear the reverberation in the room. And the reason for that is I need to buy a carpet. If that's not good enough, we're going to have to put some stuff on the walls here. We're going to have to do something to make this room more sound better, you know, just sound better. Right now, there's a little bit of that echo thing going on. But hopefully it's not too bad. Hopefully it doesn't disrupt your ability to listen too badly. Okay, a few things. Today's one of our short news briefings, Yaron's news briefing episodes. And I've got a few things I want to cover from the news. I do want to admit to maybe making a mistake or maybe jumping to conclusions on some previous shows on a couple of issues. So we all know that I will admit when I don't have all the facts. So two issues. One was the issue of crack versus opioid. And I mentioned that I thought racism was involved. And a lot of people have called me out on this. Now, I still think racism plays a factor. I believe, and we'll talk about this more on future shows, that racism is a problem in this country, that racism has not just gone away and disappeared. And, you know, once we had the 60s, it was all finished. And that many of the racist tendencies in this country that have lasted well beyond the 1960s into American culture today, particularly with the older generation. I think it's less so with younger people. But even with younger people, the alt-right is a young person's phenomena. But I admit that I do not have the facts to justify the crack versus opioid claim that I made. I'd have to do more research. I'm going to. It's a complicated issue. The whole drug issue is a complicated issue. And for example, sentencing guidelines have changed. The original sentencing guidelines were changed under Obama, but even those sentencing guidelines, I think, were changed in the late 1990s. So the original sentencing guidelines in the 80s were very different than what we see today. There's a lot of other stuff. There's a lot of other stuff that is related to our approach to drugs that is fundamentally different. I think the biggest one with regard to crack versus opioids is that crack and methamphetamines and meth, both, are uppers. They're both drugs that cause people to wake up, to get more intense, more focused, more crazy, more violent. Both associated with violence. Both associated, particularly the crack epidemic, was associated with a huge rise in violent crime all across the United States. And so, I think that's part of the reason there was such a huge clamping down on crack versus the opioid epidemic, which opioids are downers. They tend to cause you to sit back and just, you know, space out. And as a consequence, you know, that is, there's less of a call because there's less violence involved with it. So there's not a lot of violence associated today with opioids. And there probably is. But the fact that violence is at a low point in American history, again, one of those Trump lies about us, this being carnage in the streets, we're at a low point in crime in terms of in American history. Therefore, there's not a big outcry to do something about this, to put them all in jail, because there's not a lot of crime right now. Doesn't seem to be it doesn't seem to be that big of a problem. Okay, let's see. Some people are complaining about the choppiness of the video. I know it's choppy for whatever reason. The video. Broadband, whatever really dropped in this room just before the show. I'm not sure why, and I didn't have time to fix it. I don't know that I can fix it. But, you know, as we learn how to use this new location, we'll figure out the various elements. I am recording it by video, so there will be a non-choppy, smooth video up on YouTube sometime tomorrow or Saturday of the show that will fix all the technical problems that you're seeing right now. So I apologize for the technical problems. You're seeing it. It's surprising that it's not choppy on Facebook, because I'm seeing it choppy. If it's not choppy on Facebook, I'll probably just download that video and load it up. But I am recording it, so we do have a high quality video no matter what. One other issue that I want to, again, I got pushed back on and I want to correct. So I want to say there's still a lot more research that I have to do on the whole drug issue and connecting it to racism, if there is a connection. I suspect there is, but it's not as simple as I originally thought. The second issue also relates to the opioids, and that has to do with the fact that I went on and on and on a few days ago, on the moral responsibility of the opioid users. And some of you took offense to that and said it's not their fault. It's the FDA. It's the war on drugs. It's the fact that they're not good painkillers because there's no incentive to create them. The fact that there are all these synthetics that are being produced because of the war on drugs and because the FDA, again, won't approve and it's too expensive to invest in new forms of drugs. And there's limited amounts of opioids. So all of that is true. Now, I don't take back what I said about the mall aspect, because if you look closely at this opioid crisis, it's not just an opioid crisis. It's combined with a suicide crisis. It's combined with a depression crisis. It's combined with a massive crisis among primarily lower middle class, working class whites. That's where the crisis happens to be. And this has to do with Donald Trump you know, the anger among their constituency that I think led to the election of Donald Trump. I think there's a whole sociological phenomenon here. And just to blame drug policy on it, I think would be wrong. I think it's a combination of a sociological problem that is exacerbated and made much, much worse, the problem. And then the overdoses on drugs and the drug misuse by an absurd drug policy by the federal government and by state governments, the criminalization of drugs. Drugs should be legal. And let me be clear, all drugs should be legal, not just marijuana. All drugs included methamphetamine and crack cocaine and powdered cocaine and opioids and everything and heroin. They should all be legal. Legality will bring about competition. Competition will bring about increasing quality. Increasing quality will bring about fewer deaths. But in addition, something that Gary Becker, the famous Chicago economist, said years ago, one of the things that drug legalizations will do will create a whole industry to provide mechanisms by which people can get off the drugs, to provide rehabilitation. It'll take the stigma away from it. It'll make the whole process of taking drugs, getting off of drugs, much easier. This is why people are so afraid of it. Much easier and much smoother, fewer deaths, less destruction of lives, less criminality, because you won't have to steal money in order to pay for your habit, because drugs will be so cheap because of competition, and you won't, the mafia won't be involved, and you won't have to have over a million people in jails because of drug violations. And, you know, the world would be just be unjust, so much of an easier, better, safer place. Now, more people would probably take drugs, and there'd be more people addicted to drugs. But that's why you would have a much robust, innovative industry to rehabilitate them. People would discover new drugs that could treat heroin addiction. You'd have facilities, you'd have treatments, you'd have everything possible. Just like when people started going off of cigarettes. A whole industry came about of patches, of gums, of all kind of, you know, meditation and hypnosis and all kinds of stuff to help people get over their addiction. The same would happen with the harder drugs. So the solution, of course, is to legalize drugs and to legalize drugs completely. Now, what I just made was kind of the practical case for legalizing drugs. But, of course, there's a moral case for legalizing drugs. It's not the role of government to intervene in our lives, to tell us what we can and cannot consume. It's not the role of government to criminalize victimless crimes. It is not the role of government to interfere with our right to commit suicide by taking drugs, or my right to sell drugs or to grow drugs or to transport drugs. None of those things are violations of rights, and therefore it's none of the government's business. And it's not the drug addict that I'm mainly concerned about. It's everybody else. It's all the people who die because of drug-related crime. It's the shootings that happen, that people, civilians accidentally get killed. It's the lives of people that get destroyed. It's the seductive nature of the drug trade that seduces so many people in the inner city and destroys their lives and leads to criminality and to failure and to giving up on life. And of course, it is the police, the corruption. When the police go after victimless crimes, it has to corrupt them. It has to pollute what it is that they do. When they have to treat a drug dealer and a murderer basically the same, it has to corrupt the way they think about the world, the way they act. And I think corruption in the police force is higher as a consequence. I think the police don't do as good of a job. I think it's incredibly dangerous for the police, for our liberties, for our protection. Our protection agency is crippled by the war of drugs. It devours resources and focus and energy, and fundamentally is corrupting. Anytime you ask law enforcement to go after people for victimless crimes. You're destroying their capacity to do their actual job. Now look, somebody say, yes, it's a mall case. Well, of course it's a mall case, but the mall and the practical are the same. It's not that the practical nature of it, the fact that actually the world would be a safer place, a better place, we would all live better, is not a good argument. That's an important argument. And it goes hand in hand with the fact that it's morally offensive. Because what is morally offensive makes the world a worse place. And what is morally valuable makes the world a better place. The moral and the practical are one. At least Ayn Rand's morality and practicality are one. Because the way Ayn Rand derives her morality is, in a sense, she induces it from those things that enhance, that make possible human flourishing. Those things that make it possible for human beings to live a good life. So if life is the standard, once you accept life as the standard, then it's an empirical question in a sense, right? What actually leads to a good life? What leads to life qua man? What kind of values? What kind of virtues? What has worked? If people lie, do they succeed in life? No, they fail. That's the practical element, right? Oh, then it must be immoral, because failure is immoral. That kind of failure, right? If there's a principle, lying, that leads to failure, then the principle is immoral. So, and then you have to look for what is moral, honesty. And then you look and you see, oh yeah, honesty is a strategy consistent with reality, with facts, with evidence. It also leads to success. So it's a process of both validating the principles of morality in reality and seeing their connections. Once, for example, you accept that rationality is your guiding virtue, then honesty is an application of it. But it's an application that you can look in reality and see its reality, its truth. So the two, the moral is the practical is the moral. This, I'll try to make this a recurring theme because it's an incredibly important point that people don't quite get. And that's why I always make the practical case and the moral case, because in a sense, they are the same case. They make the complete argument. All right, so drugs should be legalized. Of course, that is the real problem behind the opioid epidemic, the crack epidemic, the cocaine epidemic. Well, not epidemics. I hate that word. Not epidemic. Crises, right? All right, and so they should all be legalized. Now, this brings me to an item in the news today, which was not a major news item, but important, I think. And that is that Jeff Sessions, either today or yesterday, issued an order at the Justice Department telling prosecutors basically not to pay attention to state law that legalizes marijuana, but to give primacy to federal law, which is their job to abide by. And therefore, gave them a green light, which had been rescinded by the Obama administration. One of the good things that Obama did, I know some of you believe Obama was the devil and didn't do anything good, but one of the good things Obama did is that he told federal prosecutors not to prosecute marijuana cases in states that had legalized marijuana. Sessions is reversing that. You're going to see a huge battle in Colorado, in California, in Washington State, anywhere where marijuana is being approved for recreational use. But even, according to Sessions, in places where it's been approved to medical use, that violates federal law, and therefore the federal government is going to go after people. Now, this sets up a big issue for Republicans, right? Because a federalism. They claim to be for federalism. The state should be able to set their own rules. As much as we can, we should push this down to the states. That's what conservatives have been arguing forever. Everything should be determined at the state level, not the federal level. We don't got federal intervention in education, in everything, that in prosecution of everything, of all these crimes. The states can handle that. That's what the Constitution said. That's what the 10th Amendment says. Whatever isn't delegated to Congress, to the federal government, is therefore either at the individual level or at the state level. Now, I think there's a huge misunderstanding of federalism and a huge misunderstanding about what it implies with regard to so-called state rights. But let's just take the conservatives' argument. Well, if that's the case, and the states want to legalize marijuana, what's the federal government got to do with it? Stay out of it. But there's a federal law. And all Sessions is saying, I mean, he's a horrible, he's the worst appointment Trump made. Of all of Trump's appointment, I mean, after Bannon, but Bannon's gone, Session is the worst appointment he made. Session is a religious, theocratic nutcase, an awful, awful, awful person. So here we are. Session is just saying to people, look, we're just following federal law. So what needs to happen? What should happen? What should happen is obvious. I mean, we should legalize drugs. That would solve all the problems, right? We should legalize it on a federal level. But at the very minimal, what the Congress should do is pass a law that says that federal law with regard to marijuana does not apply in states that legalized it. It would be very simple. It would grant state rights on the issue of marijuana. And it would be easy. A pot. Anybody here want to take a bet that ain't happening? Let's bet. Anybody? Any amount? I'm in Puerto Rico now. I can afford bigger bets now. Absolutely no question the feds won't do it. And, of course, this is the Trump administration, the executive branch, which is going to be going after both California, Colorado, and other states. It's going to be interesting to watch. It's going to be fascinating because the left is arguing for state rights. The left is saying, wait a minute, states should be allowed to do this. Some people actually think that this is good because it's going to encourage the left to be more open to states' rights arguments in the future. No, it isn't. They're complete pragmatists. They'll use whatever argument fits whatever they want to achieve. And right now they want to achieve drug legalizations, pot legalization at least. They'll argue state rights. They'll argue something else. They'll be against it, next time. So, you know, this is just a complete disaster, but why is anybody surprised? Let's hope Sessions is fired. Somebody on the chat is claiming he'll be fired by Monday. We'll hold you to that, but even if he's fired, who's going to replace him is the question, and anybody similar to Sessions is going to be absolutely horrific. So the moral of the story is just legalize drugs at the federal level, decriminalize them completely, get the government out of telling us what we can and can't consume. Now, of course, the most important drugs that should be decriminalized are drugs produced, invented by the pharmaceutical industry, by biotech industry. The real drugs that need that we want a flood of, that are life enhancing, that are pro human beings, that are pro life, that should be, everywhere, then the federal government should have no involvement in. Other drugs that pharmaceuticals make and that, the FDA is in charge of blocking and probably costing all of us decades of life, decades. The fascists at the FDA want to control your life. And they're just as bad, if not worse, under Republican administrations than they are under Democratic administrations. The FDA is a disaster under both, but particularly Republicans. So That is the real drug war. The real drug war is on the is on prescription drugs. The real drug war is on new antibiotics, on new cures for cancer, on new life extension drugs. That's the real drug war. That's what the government is really engaged in. And they're effective. They can't stop cocaine. They can't stop opioids. They can't stop any of that. But what they can stop is legal, is the legal production of legal drugs, so-called legal drugs, the drugs that actually enhance life. They criminalize those. Just imagine if you got your hands on some experimental drug that might actually cure your cancer, or at least would give you a shot at curing your cancer, because you're going to die anyway. And the government says, no, you can't take it. And if you do take it, we're going to put you in jail, and you can die there. Wow. That's the role of government? To tell us what drugs we can consume, to interfere in what we and our doctor think is the best treatment for ourselves? That's what government is for? No. That is the rights-violating nature of government today. And to me, that is the bigger problem of drugs. It's not the... how do we call the... I'm not sure what the word is for the heroines and the cokes and the opioids and all of those as compared to pharmaceutical drugs. Anyway, the real tragedy is what the FDA is doing. At the end of the day, it's all about freedom. About freedom. All right, let's see. I've got a few... by the way, you can call with questions. Anybody have a question, you can call 347-324-3075. 347. I know a lot of you have questions. You just call. 347-324-3075. Much easier than me trying to keep tab on the chats and trying to pick up questions off of the chats. Just call, and then everybody can hear your call as well. 347-324-3075. And don't forget, after you call, to press 1. I guess you could differentiate between recreational drugs and drugs that are meant to cure diseases or to extend life or to enhance life. But of course, opioids do both, right? Opioids both reduce pain, which is important for life, and can also be used and are used as recreational drugs. All right, nobody wants to call today. I've got somebody on, this is the second day now, that Brian on YouTube has asked me to comment about Shapiro, who was very dismissive and disrespectful of objectivism. I will. I just need to devote more time, and it's not. This is not the format to do it, but I'll do that in one of my Living Objectivism talks, or maybe one of my Radical Capitalism talks podcasts in the next week or so. I will go and listen to Ben's comments that he had on Rubin, and you know, Shapiro called objectivism garbage, I guess, on that show. All right. We will take that up on a future episodes, I promise. And of course, if I ever get to debate Shapiro, if you'll do that, we'll take that up in person. I mean, if Shapiro thinks objectivism is garbage, then that just means he is garbage, but so be it. He's good on what a lot of conservatives are good at. A lot of conservatives are good on polemics. They're good on polemics. Okay. Puerto Rico, people asking a lot of questions about Puerto Rico. I wonder if Puerto Rico will be required to raise taxes in the near future to pay for and reimburse all the costs of their recovery, because the fact is that there is no such thing as free money. Now, I doubt that will happen, primarily because Texas isn't being asked to raise taxes in order to pay for their recovery. Florida isn't. A precedent that said that a state had to pay the federal government back for the money that it provided would be a pretty amazing precedent, and would screw up our whole tax and redistribution mechanisms in the U.S., and nobody would go for it. For example, California, as much as we love to hate California, California sends more money to the federal government than it gets, even though it has more welfare recipients than any other state in the country. I think a quarter of all welfare recipients in California. The fact is that it sends more money to the federal government than it receives. But there are lots of states that where it's the opposite. States like Mississippi and states that are very Republican are exactly the opposite. They receive much more money from the federal government than they send to Washington. So there's no way we're going to start this process. What happens with an earthquake? Is California going to have to pay extra? It's just nobody's going to do that. Of course, none of these bailouts should happen. My preference for Puerto Rico is for ultimately for it to leave the United States. I think that not while I'm living here. I like the fact that I can travel in and out of Puerto Rico without a passport, and that I am a don't have to give up my U.S. citizenship to get the tax benefits that I'm getting by living in Puerto Rico. But yeah, I hope it doesn't become a state. That would destroy things for me. But it won't, and it won't become a state in the foreseeable future. Which means the next decade, which is what I am concerned about. Not concerned about much beyond the next decade right now. All right. Yeah, sound on Blog Talk for those of you is fine. Today is actually really good. So if you're having a hard time listening on some of the other platforms, you can shift over to Blog Talk. No callers, 347-324-3075. Okay, one more topic and we'll call it quits. All right. Let's see. All right. So this book, the book that's coming out in the Trump administration, it's going to tell us all the deuts about the Trump administration. What's amazing to me about the book is everything it's saying is only confirming what I've been telling you about Trump from way back, from before, you know, while during the primaries of the Republicans. He's unqualified to take the job. He never thought he would win. He doesn't really, in some sense, want the job. He has no idea what to do with the job. All of that is known. I mean, there's no big secret here. There's no big reveal. Some of the personal stories are interesting, particularly the Bannon quotes, which are hard to understand why Bannon would say all the things that he said. He supposedly was trying to build a new conservative movement around Trump's ideas, alienating himself from Trump. I don't see how that works in Bannon's favor, unless he believes that Trump is not going to last. That is, Trump is going to either not run for second term, lose, or even leave before the 2020 election. So if Bannon believes that, then it makes a lot of sense for him to position himself as the guy who said, told you so, Trump was bad, sorry I helped to get him elected, or I helped him get elected, but then he was clearly unqualified for the job and he screwed it all up. Now, what I'm hoping is that Bannon loses all credibility as a consequence of this, because as I've said many times, I think Bannon in many respects is worse than Trump, and Bannon is the worst of the Republican Party. And from the little I'm reading today, it looks like Bannon is really taking a hit. I mean, there's even talk about maybe him losing his job at Breitbart. We'll see if that actually happens. But that Bannon is really taking a hit from this, and congressmen and the people he's backing in congressional races are second-guessing their decision to be on the Bannon bandwagon. So some good could come out of all of this, and the good that comes out of all of this is Bannon disappears. I mean, I can't think of anything better politically for the United States long term than Bannon just going away and having no role in the politics of the United States of America. That would be an excellent outcome. And yes, I know some of you think I'm still at the end of the day, I'm going to apologize about Trump, about criticizing Trump. You know, I hope that's true, I guess. But it can't be true because A is A, and the guy is what he is. All right, I've said enough. And here he is, right? He is today doing his stuff, right? So this book is coming out. Now, there's been a trashy book about every president that's ever held office. Nothing's new here. I mean, the only issue here is this book might be true. But there were books about Obama and how awful he was and how terrible it was with lies and truths mixed up. There were books about Bush. There were books about Clinton. There were books about Jimmy Carter. There'd be books about every president. But, you know, it takes a big person to accept that there's a book that he doesn't like out there on the market. But Trump is not a big person. Trump is a little person. He's a very, very, very little person. And, of course, what does he do? The first thing he does is he's sent a letter to the publisher. His lawyer has sent a letter to the publisher of the book telling to cease and desist from publication, not to publish the book, and threatening them with lawsuits. And of course, the letter uses the term actual malice, which raises the prospect of a libel, a defamation case that Trump would use against the publisher. Now, this is pretty scary stuff, people. This is free speech issues. This is the president of the United States. He's a public figure. People are going to write all kinds of stuff about this. Now, the irony here is, and God, I'm going to try not to get angry here because some of you are Trump fans, and the mind boggles. The mind boggles, right? This is a man who accused the president of the United States, Obama, of not having been born in the United States. This is a man who perpetuated a conspiracy theory. If that's not defamation, if that's not libel, I don't know what it is. He pursued it and pursued it and pursued it for years after everybody else had given up. He was still a truther. That should have disqualified him for being president of the United States forever. Forever. Anybody who perpetuates conspiracy theory should never be president of the United States. The truth of conspiracy should have been enough to disqualify Trump from ever being president. Yeah, I know some of you think that the truth of conspiracy is true. You guys are crazy. There's nothing I can do for you or with you. And he has the ridiculous notion of then saying, oh, this book about me, which quotes people within his administration. This is now defamation and libel. This is horrible. This is unacceptable. This guy who defames anybody, who called people names, who accused Ted Cruz's father for maybe conspiring against Kennedy this is the guy who made comments about Carly Fiorina's looks. This brute has the audacity to argue against the book that calls him out on his behavior as president of the United States. Give me a break. I'm not thin-skinned. If I got angry when you came after me, then I would be thin-skinned. Getting angry about something that Trump does and says and his hypocrisy and dishonesty, that is worthy of anger. That is worthy of anger. Right? Trump, one of the biggest liars that have ever been on a presidential stage, for him to do this. But the real scary thing is here again. This is the whole freedom of speech angle here is what is really scary. And the idea that the president of the United States is telling a publisher not to publish a book. I don't care what's in the book. I don't care even if there are lies in the book. He is president of the United States. He is a public figure. This is what freedom means. Right? All right. It truly is stunning to me the leeway that... you see, Trump doesn't surprise me. Trump is just Trump. I mean, he is what he is. And again, many of us have diagnosed Trump long time ago, so this is not surprising or new. And his attitude towards the media and his attitude towards truth is well known, and we've talked about it. But what shocks me is how his supporters are blind to everything he does. I go back, something I mentioned on, I think, yesterday or the day before, whenever, is his, Trump's own statement that he could shoot somebody in the middle of Sixth Avenue and people would still vote for him. And that's right. Yeah, I'm a public figure too. Not quite president of the United States. And people have written books and people write comments and you should look at some of the websites out there. And the names they call me, I don't get livid. I don't get upset. I don't send them letters, you know, part of the game. You see the kind of tweets people send me when I'm going to sue everybody who says something not nice about me, anything or publishes something bad about me. I mean, go read some of the books that have been published in the last 5-10 years about objectivism and how they talk about me. Or I'm not going to refer to the website. There's a whole website dedicated to attacking me. A whole website just to attacking me. Goes into great detail. I'm a, you know, on what kind of a monster I am. You know, so what? I mean, I've never talked about it. I've never gotten angry about it. I've never written nasty letters about it. How was it? I'm not running. My political goals have shifted. I am now, I'm gonna explore the possibility. I mean, I'm joking, right? But I'm gonna explore the possibility of running for governor of Puerto Rico. And as governor of Puerto Rico, declaring independence and splitting off from the United States and establishing basically Puerto Rico as the Hong Kong of the Caribbean. That's a worthy goal. What do you think? Would you all move here if we could pull this off? So that's Peter and my scheme. We're going to take over the Puerto Rican government and turn it into Hong Kong. All right. Oh, we got a caller. All right. We're just going to take one call because we're already running late. Hi, you're on the Yvonne Brooks Show. Who's this?
Hi, it's Nathan. How you doing?
Hey, Nathan. I'm doing well. How about you?
Good. I got a quick question. A little while back, Trump made a comment how with the tax bill that was passed, and they repealed the mandate from the health care laws, that it effectively neutered Obamacare. I don't know if you've spoken on that, but could you address that? How true is that? What does that do to the Obamacare?
Well, it neuters a big, the most contentious part in a sense of Obamacare, which is the mandate. It basically takes away the mandate. So what Obamacare did was said, if you, and this is why Judge Roberts allowed it, because he viewed it not so much as a mandate, but more of a tax issue, which was his screwy way of thinking about it. But it is a tax issue in this sense. What they said was, Obamacare says, is if you don't have health insurance, you have to pay a tax penalty. So when you file your taxes, you have to prove that you have health insurance. And if you cannot prove it, basically you pay more taxes. And so Robert said, this is not a mandate, it's just tax policy, and therefore you allowed it. So what the Republicans have done is basically taken away the tax penalty. So now, if you want to have health insurance, fine. If you don't want to have health insurance, you can do it, and there's no downside to not having health insurance. Now, that doesn't do anything to the – now, oh, this is the important point. The reason they needed the mandate to make Obamacare work is that the mandate was supposed to force young people who don't typically buy health insurance. It was meant to force them to buy health insurance so that then they would subsidize old people who had pre-existing conditions and who were sick. So the whole point of Obamacare was to get as many young people into the insurance pool so that you could subsidize, so the insurance companies would be willing then to lower rates on middle age and old people who cost insurance companies a lot of money. When you take away the penalty, a lot of young people don't have an incentive to buy health insurance because they're healthy. So they figure they'll take the risk. But it doesn't completely neuter Obamacare in this sense, that young people are also incentivized to buy the health insurance with subsidies. So, for example, I was helping my son tried to buy health insurance on Covered California. And if you have a certain level of income or below, the government is basically paying 3/4 of your health insurance. So a young person has an incentive to buy it because the government's going to pick up the tab anyway. So it kind of neuters. It takes away a big chunk of it, which is good, but it still leaves kind of the framework in existence. And of course, a Democratic president or a Democratic Congress in the future can put back the mandate very easily now. They haven't repealed the whole thing, which is what they need to do. They have to repeal the subsidies as a whole, which is what they failed to do you know, the Republicans failed to do earlier in the year. Does that make sense?
So what currently exists from the bill
so right
that
now,
wasn't there before Obama passed it?
So what exists that wasn't there before Obamacare are these exchanges where only certain types of policies approved by the governments are being offered, and where people below a certain income level get a government subsidy directly. So it's kind of a tax credit. They get a direct subsidy that lowers their cost significantly. So that all exists. And I'm sure there are a lot of other technicalities and issues that exist. There's a whole other, all the regulatory aspects of Obamacare, the regulations of insurance companies, what kind of policies can be offered, all of that still exists. And nothing's changed on the insurance side. The only thing that's changed is you don't get penalized if you don't have insurance. It's the only thing that's changed.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Sure. All right. Thank you. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. We will be on Saturday at 12 o'clock noon Pacific time. So 1 o'clock Puerto Rico time, 9 a.m. Pacific time for The Blaze, for Radical Capitalist. And then I'll be back with a Living Objectivism show, and I'll probably be taking on Ben Shapiro's claim about objectivism in his latest interview with Dave Rubin. All right. Thanks all for listening. Don't forget to support the show on Patreon. Go to Patreon, Yaron Brooks Show. You know, even a little bit matters. $2, $5 a month helps a lot. We're trying to get up to $6,000 a month. We're trying to get the number of contributors to 1,000. And ultimately, I want to get up to 10,000 a month and much, much more. But 6,000 is a good goal. We're more than halfway there. You guys can help me get there. Maybe 2, 3, 4 months, we can be there. It's up to you. And with raising that, we're going to continue to buy better and more equipment. We already have great equipment here. I bought a preamp. I've got dual monitors, 34-inch curved. We've got a great computer running all this. I need to still fix the broadband. Sound is good. We need to do more marketing. There's a lot of stuff to do. And I need a producer, and I need tons of stuff. And that's what will make possible with your contributions. So thank you for your support, those of you already contributed. Those of you who haven't, go do it now. It's a great way to start the new year. Talk to you Saturday. Thanks, everybody.